Committee on Regional Affairs will come to order. Let the record reflect that we finally have a quorum. Representative Cessna, Representative Ledoux, Co-Chair Thomas, and myself, Olson. The first item on the agenda will be House Bill 28. You're up, Adam.
Good morning. For the record, my name's Adam Berg, staff to Representative Moses. Let me give his apologies, first of all, for not being here this morning. He's on his way back now, but he didn't want to delay the chance to get his bill heard. So I'm here to introduce House Bill 28, bill establishing the Municipal Dividend Fund. What the bill proposes to do is give every incorporated municipality in the state an amount of money based on their population. The intent is to empower local officials by allowing them to decide how best to spend that money within their communities. The formula for calculating the dividends is $250 per person and a minimum payment of $40,000 per municipality. Boroughs would also receive a dividend, that formula being total population of the borough and subtract the total population of incorporated municipalities within the borough. Money would come from the earnings reserve account and would only come after permanent fund dividends have been accounted for and inflation proofing has taken place. And in the event the earnings reserve account is less than the sum total of the municipal dividend payments, dividends would be reduced on a pro rata basis. That's the basics of the bill. Here to answer any questions.
We're a lively group.
Yeah. It's early.
See, no questions from the committee. We'll start with public testimony in the audience, I guess. Kathy Wasserman?
I'm going to defer to
Kevin Ritchie. Morning, Kevin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kevin Ritchie with the Alaska Municipal League. And Kathy would like to say a few things. I thought I'd go first. And this is a basically a twofer. This will be essentially the same information for this bill as well as the revenue sharing bill. I wanted to just provide some background information, and I think that all of you are very knowledgeable about what's happening with small cities, but I wanted to make sure you had some information to share with other legislators. I think the two things that are really key in this issue is there's been a shift of really shifting away from local services and local issues, local economic development over the past 10 years, and it pretty much came to a head with the elimination of funding for revenue sharing last year. And next year at this time, I believe there's very observable facts that we will have about half the small cities next year that we have today. We've already lost 9, and at least 17 are financially so far in debt that it's unlikely they'll be able to recover. And what does that really mean? Culturally, you know, these little communities are poor, but they've been there for thousands of years. Over the past 50 years, we have brought up the standard of living in small communities so they can expect some public safety, can expect to get their children out if they're injured. They can usually fly out or drive out. Those services are actually being lost, and people are going to be migrating to larger communities. The second thing is in the larger communities, the larger communities are losing their ability to take care of problems. We now have some of the highest property taxes in the United States in many of our communities, and some of the highest total local taxes of any communities in our country. That's kind of shocking to most people, and that's why I provided most of this information for you. Just real quickly to go over it, the small piece of paper with the ML logo on the top, that is a summary from the Department of Community Economic Development, Commerce Community Economic Development. Well, it contains the summary from that department of what's happening to our small cities. And then the rather large packet is actual letters from many of the communities that are being impacted. And there are some really compelling stories in there about people who, you know, the level of service has dropped to the point in communities where if there's an emergency, there's times when they can't get to the airport or the airport isn't serviceable. That's a problem that nobody would accept in urban Alaska. The green piece of paper, one sheet has a graph on it. That is as factual as we can make it. The top line shows property tax increases since 1986. That is the total number from the state assessor, and so that is absolute fact. It's a little harder to make some of the estimates below, but in terms of the elimination of revenue sharing, the senior citizen veterans property tax exemption underfunding, and so on, those are also very observable numbers. But it shows a real connection between state funding and property taxes, which is pretty good considering inflation and all the other cost increases and challenges that cities have. They've really fared pretty well except for the continuing state cuts to programs that have been very traditional. In case you like numbers, I just put a piece of paper that will give you some actual comparisons with property tax rates around the country on one side, and then on the other side is comparison of per capita taxes in Alaska, and that would be an interesting comparison to make. Obviously, the one piece of information which I think is most significant is that Anchorage's property taxes, there's a study, national study done each year by Washington, D.C., actually the District of Columbia, of all the tax burdens in the largest cities in every state in the United States. And Anchorage's property taxes are 17th in the nation for the year 2003. Now, that's not picking out Anchorage, but that just happened to be the test city. Then if you turn over the page, this is actually a page out of the Alaska Taxable, which is put together by the Office of the State Assessor, that shows per capita taxation in communities around Alaska. And actually, Anchorage comes in 31st in per capita taxation in Alaska, meaning that it's almost the smallest of all the major urban areas. And then the very last page, and this is a bill that I believe you'll be talking more about. One of the major factors for rising taxes in communities is the fact that the state has not fulfilled its statutory obligation to reimburse municipalities for the senior citizen property tax exemption. And this just shows a history of the program. Again, the history of the program came from the state assessor's office. We changed the graph from a bar graph to a hill graph, but it pretty much shows the rise of the program. So anyway, just in summary, what you do here this year can save half of the small cities in Alaska, which is a major, major thing for our state. I think in the future, the richest of our state is going to be we're going to be a lot poorer for losing many of our communities and having many more people move to urban areas. And the economy of our state actually is dependent in large part upon commerce between the different cities. And Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and the larger urban areas depend on commerce to a great extent with the small communities. And two is losing the flexibility in our larger communities to deal with issues and problems, economic development, crime, and so on. So both of these bills, municipal dividend and revenue sharing, can be crucial in allowing those small cities to exist and in really changing the ability of larger communities to deal with local problems. So anyway, thank you very much.
Representative Ledoux.
Did I understand you to say that Alaska has some of the highest local taxes in the nation?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm looking at this chart that you gave us, the comparison of local taxes nationwide in Alaska, and while property taxes look like they come in 17th in Anchorage, for example, looks like the whole, like Anchorage, if you consider everything, comes in 50th, doesn't it?
Through the chair, that was a great question. Thank you. Yes. This chart covers state and local taxes throughout the nation, and so it's a total local, it's a total state and local tax burden. And obviously, we're the only state that doesn't have state taxes. So overall, absolutely. The significance of having really high property taxes and very high local taxes is in part a comparison with other states. Other states, almost all other states do provide significant sharing of revenues with their communities. And also, when any one tax gets out of whack, like for example, Wrangell has a 7% sales tax, six other communities have 6% sales tax, you know, cost of business is high up here anyway. When you start adding a really high sales tax and or a really high property tax, you lose even more of the competitive edge with the rest of the country.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Sussman.
Well, thank you, and I guess the thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess my question to you is, and I asked this question last year, and I don't think it was this bill, but it was something similar, and that is, so why do we want small communities? And I think that this sort of comes straight at this. I did have my trips this last year to the 21 different communities, and I saw this happening. I was watching it happen. And in all those conversations, hearing the links between the different jobs in small towns, the fact that if you take out one significant job, you create a whole ripple effect throughout the whole community. And that was what I was hearing over and over and over again, and that it was happening. And as the summer progressed into fall, it was happening more and more and more, and you were watching towns go down. So I'm not surprised to hear what you're saying. It just confirms what I was seeing just in being not quite a casual observer, but nonetheless talking to administrators and all the different kind of municipal key functions. And it makes me know that what we do here actually has an effect. I know it has an effect. And it's not just this revenue sharing. The revenue sharing is, and this does a good job of showing how important that is. But at the same time, it's a lot of the other policies that we make. And somehow, this is good, but it still doesn't explain what I think this body needs to know. And I'm talking about the larger body, but this committee is right there. That's our job here, is community and regional affairs. Why, I think you need to know why you need incentives for small towns and why small towns mean a lot to the state. I found out myself, and I hope you still think this is relevant to this. I hope I'm not talking too long, but in my own district, it's the core of the health services in the state, and I have all the big institutions, kind of the institutions of last resort are in my community. And so I go around and talk to them. What they were reporting was a huge influx. They said, one agency said 3,000 people in 1 year increase in consumers. And what that does to the institutions in my district is capacity. It starts eroding their capacity, which starts first of all affecting the quality, and then it'll up the costs. So you're driving costs up in one part, and the costs because of the uninsured in the small communities that is going up rapidly too, it's the imbalance is actually driving up costs on both sides for different reasons. So those kinds of things, and I think there must be many, many different kinds of things like that. Capacity is one huge problem, and we as a state have to be paying attention to where our policy fits into this. And part of the policy is if we want our own state costs in health to be in line, something we can possibly control, then we want to have policies that actually will keep things kind of stable if we possibly can. And it's worth revenue sharing just to have state health costs, $1.8 billion for next year, try to keep those in line and not have them grow. I think it's a direct result, but can you maybe add more to that?
Mr. Chairman,
was there a question in there for Mr. Ritchie?
Yeah, it's a huge question.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to answer that question two ways. One, I think, is what is the value of small cities to the small cities? What is the value of small cities to Alaska as a whole? The first question about what is the value of small cities, I've heard a number of people say over the past year or two that the West is littered with small towns that didn't make it, and they dried up and became ghost towns. And I think that is very true in many communities where, say, a mine opened back in the 1800s and a lot of people moved into town, the gold got mined out, and then all those people moved on someplace else. That was hardly a culture or a broad impact. In Alaska, nearly all of our very small rural towns are poor. Nearly all of our really small rural towns have a rich cultural history. They've been around for thousands of years. I think most people would, when they think of Alaska, they probably, as a very important part of what they think of, as they think of rural Alaska and the people that live there and the culture. What we've done in the past 50 years with revenue sharing is allow, and other programs as well, obviously, is allowed these small communities to have the kind of, well, not as good a public safety as you'd have other places, but an acceptable level of public safety, acceptable level of transportation services, acceptable level of road maintenance that allows you to get out of the house to someplace else. The quality of life is going down in these towns to the extent that they're moving out. On this piece of paper here, number three, is it the out-migration of rural natives from their homes in rural Alaska has accelerated over the past 30 years. In the last decade alone, 11,000 Alaska Natives, nearly 10% of the rural population, migrated out of their communities. That's from a University of Alaska study, ICER, that was released a couple months ago. The second question is, what value do these small communities have to the state of Alaska? Economically, about 1 out of 5 jobs in urban areas is selling things to other areas of the state. If you want to look at these small communities, they're sort of like urban ATM machines that don't run out of money. If you look at the jobs around Anchorage or Fairbanks or Juneau or any of our urban areas, a fair number of those jobs, estimated 20% by through an economic study that's done about 5 or 6 years ago, serves other parts of the state. And how does that economy work if there's really poor small communities? Well, those poor small communities are magnets for federal money, you know, that isn't available otherwise. They also have, you know, fairly significant tourism starting up in some areas and so on. And so the economics of the state as a whole, if we lose a lot of small communities or if small communities shrink to the extent that they're no longer viable communities. What is happening is, as Representative Sitna said, is more people are moving into the urban areas, and then the urban areas are losing some of the jobs that serve the rural areas. And so you've got sort of a double whammy economically. Does that help? Okay.
It's on.
I'd like the record to reflect that we've been joined by Representative Salmon. Good morning. Representative Ledoux.
You've been talking, Kevin, about the value of the small communities around the state. Well, many of the small communities around the state, they're actually not municipalities right now. They're operated through tribal governments. And I don't think that this municipal dividend program includes those tribal governments. Don't those entities, aren't there the same problems there financially and so forth in those areas?
Mr. Chairman, first of all, I'm not really competent to speak on the funding for tribes. They do have a funding stream different than municipalities. What I would say, though, is there's so little money out in much of rural Alaska is if the tribal government or the municipal government either doesn't work together or one of them goes away, that has serious impacts upon the quality of life in the community. Then there's some communities that have no municipal government at all, and they're very small, and in some cases have no tribe either. And those communities are part of the legislature's unorganized borough to a large extent. We're the municipal league, of course, and we spend all our time thinking about municipalities, but I think the legislature as a whole would be well served to look at all communities and what can be done to assist them.
Thank you.
Go for it.
Thank you. On your handout you had here, struggling with financial situations, it's one.
Yes, sir.
And I was reading, says that you eliminate core municipal services such as police protection, closures of washerias. You mean to some governments, local governments, provide washerias to people in town?
You're the chair, yes. They do the washerias. Sometimes they're through the health corporation, sometimes through the municipality. And just for anybody who hasn't, if there is not running water in a community or sewer, that the washateria becomes a center for washing clothes, washing yourself, getting water, and so on.
Just to follow up on that answer, many small communities run the sewer and water plant. And also in the washateria or the laundromat is attached to that water generation plant and the sewage treatment. And it's kind of what many communities feel is that it fits under the heading of public health. If there's like a lice breakout in a community, before we had washaterias, it was almost impossible to get rid of the lice or any kind of other communicable disease or communicable epidemic. It's really hard to wash out the clothes and get a shower. And actually now what we're starting to see is traditionally we had steam baths, and now because of the high level of prescribing of antibiotics, we're seeing more and more bacteria that are harder to kill off. And so right now in a lot of our steam baths, there are big boils that are transmitted by steam bath that are really hard to get rid of. You basically have to burn your steam bath down. And actually, I had a cousin die from that. It was a boil, and it got infected with staph, and then her blood became infected. So right now, there's an even, with the steam bath boils, and as serious as they are, the washateria is becoming even more important.
Any other questions for
just coming back to the Kevin here? You know, I live in a community that's economically depressed, and of course, you know, originally it comes from the village of Kluckman, and we're all centered around, the villages were centered around a resource, and that was either fisheries or hunting, and lived off that. But recently, with no economy in hands, I have five kids, four boys, and one daughter. Three of them have had to leave Alaska because the economy in the southeast is so bad, there's no jobs here. So, well, I guess you could say reason people are migrating. I think Cake lost 200 people over the last year and a half that have moved to Juneau for jobs. When you shut down the timber industry in the southeast and there's no fishing, they sold their permits and they migrate to where the jobs are, because growing up, my grandmother said the one number one thing that would make us successful is education. Everybody strives to have their child get educated. Then all of a sudden you're in Nooksack and you get a master's degree. What are you going to do in there? So you have to migrate, and you take with you probably your girlfriend. So you lose, several people. Then pretty soon, as they get older, the parents get older, just come to town. We'll take care of you. You can't do it out there. So I guess you're saying we encourage the migration by ourselves by trying to achieve and to be successful. So it happens, but you don't like it to happen. I know that several of my communities are struggling and trying to keep their identity. I see them on your list.
Mr. Chairman, sort of a response, but I think that's an excellent, you know, question. How do municipalities fit into that picture? What's happening around, for example, many of the communities in the Southeast is a major industry shuts down, and they're struggling to recreate themselves, to bring in new industry, to buoy up manufacturing or something else, tourism, whatever. But when that initial wave of people have to leave town, what happens is all the infrastructure stays, and then the taxes either go up or the service goes down. Either high taxes or poor services are going to push more people out that didn't want to leave and make it that much harder to recover. And then when the state eliminates revenue sharing, doesn't help out with the PERS in cost increase and so on, that's just kind of pushing that community that much farther down, making it likely that many more people will leave and that new industry or that revival will never happen.
Thank you. One thing that I've noticed through the years is that when timber was king in Southeast and we had a lot of limited entry permit holders and IFQ individual fish quota holders in the villages, but fish prices dipped and longshoring and logging came along, and so you can make $60,000 to $70,000 longshoring and logging versus $15,000 fishing. So pretty obvious which of the guys gonna do. You get your permit, you're gonna sell your permit and go logging. Well, logging didn't last forever, and IFQs were gone, your fishing quotas, and they turned around and said, well, now we have nothing, because you know, the bubble burst, and now they're stuck out there. So, and just a comment, you know, of watching for years what's been going on, it just helped them dig a big hole, I guess.
Any other questions for Mr. Ritchie? Thanks, Kevin, or Representative Salmon.
I don't have a question, but I think what I heard since I came in here, and I think I spoke out on that last bill that came up, $50,000 per municipality. This is kind of similar bill that, you know, goes by population, the amount of money they get to each municipality. We, you know, like what Co-Chair Thomas said, that as we, you know, take a lot of these funds away from our community, I mean, we're getting to a point where everybody needs to move to Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Juneau, you know, and that's what we need to shy away from. I mean, the more funds we take away from the villages that are really needs it, it's the ones that are not on here on this list. And, you know, as state of Alaska, we need to provide our citizens with our communities. I mean, just because we're tribal communities in some communities doesn't mean that we're not part of Alaska. So we need to look at it as a whole, that the problem exists not only for these communities, it exists for the smaller communities too, to support that and to continue their efforts to carry on. And that's some of the things that people in this, I'd say Alaska, that doesn't see that. I mean, they think a small community is just sitting there not providing the economic factors for the state. I mean, we help out in a way, and we're part of the formula. If we took all the small communities and stuck them into Fairbanks and Anchorage, what would that leave? It'd leave no Alaska. You wouldn't have no airports to maintain. You wouldn't have to be worried about all these airports. You'd have to worry about three airports. Those are things that we have to think about, you know. I mean, these areas, we're looking at the other laws that that affect it. The environmentalists, they're helping and decreasing. The fur industry, which used to be big, that's going down, you know. I mean, fishing is going down. Timber is going down. All the little things that we used to live off of is going down, and now we're seeing money as our basis for what we're going forward for. I mean, you know, it's not fish, it's no more matter of animals anymore. I mean, we have to look at those factors, you know. We can't just look at money anymore.
Any other questions for Mr. Ritchie?
Just, we have other people to talk
yeah.
to.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you very much.
Kathy Wasserman.
For the record, my name is Kathy Wasserman with the Alaska Municipal League. I'll try not to go over the same information that Kevin just covered. I had a little more of a planned talk until I heard some of the questions, and then, of course, you know, I could talk for an hour and a half, but I won't. I would like to say, first of all, that with my experience as the mayor for 8 years of one of these small communities that is on that list, I have my own ideas on how it is getting virtually impossible to operate a small community. When I first moved to Pelican, we had revenue sharing, we had the capital matching grant, and we even still had law enforcement. By the time I left, we had no law enforcement. People would, if there was some sort of incident with guns, they would call me at my house in the middle of the night, and needless to say, I didn't go down. I don't respond to gunshots until it's all over. So it's very difficult to be able to take care of a small community when you have no money coming in. Kevin and I were talking on the way up the hill, and he made a very good point that I have heard, and we have both heard as we try to lobby for communities, that there are some communities that just don't operate wisely. Well, that may be true, but that's only a few, and it can be said that sometimes the state of Alaska doesn't operate wisely either, and God forbid that Washington, D.C. should say, well, let's just cut them off. So we would hope that because of some of the problems that small communities go through, that the state could help give them the tools in order to have them get back to be a viable community. Just last week at Southeast Conference, the governor spoke, and he talked about how great things were in the state of Alaska, and I was thinking, you know, it's all location, location, location. If you live in downtown Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks, Kodiak, Kenai, it may be very nice, but if you're living in Scammon Bay or Neustoyahuck, it might not be that good. You may not be able to keep your water on, you can't keep your lights on. In Neustoyahuck, a couple of weeks ago, their fire truck was frozen, a fire erupted, and they lost the building. They couldn't even respond because they have no money to heat their fire department or the building in which their fire truck starts. But when the governor gave that talk, I thought, we're doing all we can to increase resources into our state and to build up businesses. And what business wants to come to the state of Alaska, and unless their workers live in the 3 or 4 or 5 major spots, they're not going to want to go out and live in any communities where the roads aren't plowed and the schools aren't good and there's no law enforcement. We would just like to reiterate that we think that these communities need the tools in order to build themselves back up to become viable communities. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Wasserman? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody in the room like to testify on this bill? I think we'll wrap it up. This is the first of
bring it into the committee.
Pardon me?
Bring it into the committee.
Anybody in the committee?
I just have a couple comments, kind of follow up with Mr. Chairman, with what Representative Salmon said. I think one of the things that I don't like on revenue sharing bills is the fact when you don't provide opportunity or money for the unorganized municipalities. 80% of, I guess you say, Alaska's wealth comes from royalties from outside the urban areas, and the impacts typically are in those areas, and I think I've been with the Village Corporation for 30 years. You can't discriminate amongst shareholders. If we're going to make a dividend, everybody gets a per share. If it's $1 a share, everybody gets $100. But here, for some reason, when people want to put out money, it's based on population, on organized municipalities. Yet the wealth of the state of Alaska comes from the oil industry, which is an asset. I always look at everybody in Alaska. So all of a sudden now we're out here because you're unorganized, you're not going to get any part of the pie. And that's one of the things that I don't like, and I haven't liked in watching down here, is when you try to share the wealth, it only goes so far. And the fact that we're all stakeholders and owners of the oil industry, I mean, we're looking at it again. We're going to build a gas pipeline, right, with our money. But again, the revenues only go back so far, and so I'm like Representative Sam. I like to see the unorganized municipalities get their share. There are people from here in Alaska. That's just a comment.
Thank you.
No questions.
Representative Sussman?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I guess that actually brings up a question. Representative Thomas's comments make me want to ask the representative for the bill sponsor if they have thought about ways to expand the impacted population. Would that be possible to bring?
Adam, would you like to respond to that?
Thank you, Adam.
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, yeah, this subject's come up, but probably every time he's had the bill up, I don't know, because I've only been with him a couple of years, but it came up last year.
Every year.
And, you know, I'll tell you, there's a couple reasons that they're not included in the bill right off the bat, and Representative Moses is open to amendments on the bill to include unincorporated. But there's a political reason, is probably the main reason for not having it in there, and that's because there is a push in the legislature to force organization of boroughs or to force organization of cities. And you're seeing it in a number of bills this year. And I mean, that's the reason. The reason we don't have them included is because we feel it's needed to get these communities some help. And whatever can make it through this legislature, that's what we wanna have done. And if including unincorporateds would kill the bill, then you know, you're not helping anybody. And I'd say that's the main reason.
Yeah. Under the old municipal revenue sharing, everybody shared them. And that's, you know, if people want to go back to the way we were, you have to include the unorganized. And you know, I can see encouraging them, using that as an apple to come out there, but I think that's like a big stick right now when we listen to the plight of the problems they've got. I mean, we argued over a raw fish tax bill in fisheries that we're talking $1,500 for some municipalities, and that was big money to them. So when you're looking at $40,000 or $25,000, major.
Through the chair, Representative Thomas, as I said, Representative Moses is open to include unorganized villages, but as long as the will of the legislature is there, we're all for it.
Would that dilute? Yeah. That would dilute the total, though. I mean, you have 160 million, I think.
You could always just add to it. You know, the main, as I said, the main thing is let's get some help out to as many folks as we can right now. I mean, this has been an ongoing problem for a number of years. It gets worse every year, and the whole goal is to help out. You know, a dollar amount, pick a dollar amount, but let's get some help out there.
Any other comments or questions from the committee? Representative Sandman?
I forget your name, but the question I had is, out of 95 villages in my district, which is District 6, 23 is on this list, and there are 72 missing out of there. I mean, what do we tell these people, you know? We can't help you because you're not Alaskans, or are you not in Alaska, or Alaska don't recognize you, or what do we tell them? What do I tell people like that? 72 communities. And speaking of supporting something like that, you know, I'd rather not even see one time go out to Alaska if we're not going to support those 72 villages. I mean, if somebody's not going, I mean, just like that, just like PFD, if you're not going to give somebody PFD because they're, you know, they're not from Alaska, or, you know, I mean, the point is I'm making is that if the village that we have on this list is going to get money, and there's 72 villages in my district, it's not going to get money, I'd rather see those people not get money because of those 72 people, you know. I mean, I'd rather see this bill dead rather than to, you know, if 72 of my villages are not going to be included, then this bill need to die. We need to send a message to the state of Alaska saying that this is a bad bill for the true Alaskans.
Through the chair, Representative Salmon, I was trying to make the point earlier, but maybe I didn't. We're open to amendments on this. The reason we don't have them included from the get-go is purely for political reasons. We want to get help to all the communities. We want to have something that's able to work its way through the process and get passed through both bodies. If the political will is there to take care of unorganized as well as organized, we're all for it.
Representative Sisman.
Thank you, and I just Representative Salmon. Some of actually, there are only two of us at this table that were here watching revenue sharing go down and out, and we have eliminated help to local communities in so many different ways. It's not just revenue sharing, but there's other ways we've also eliminated help. So, how do we turn that one? Because I do believe that we're talking about changing the nature of what Alaska is if we don't act fairly soon. I think that's precisely what's happening. So I would like to see this committee actually do something on this bill and either move it along as it is right now or add something to it, but do something.
Well, we're not going to be doing anything today, but there'll be time for Representative Salmon to get together with the sponsor of the bill and voice his concerns and see what he can do.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Adam.
Thank you.
We're going to be moving on to House Bill 36.
Mr. Chairman, plural, I'm Representative Kapsner from Bethel, and before you is House Bill 36. I believe everybody has the Y version in front of them. It's just a simple one-page bill. Famous last words, right? Simple one-page
yes.
bill. Well, I'm disappointed that the previous bill didn't pass out, didn't move along, I should say, because that was the municipal dividend program really is a long-term fix. The bill before you is a one-year fix for FY06, and it would take effect July 1, 2005. And what the bill does is it reinstates municipal assistance and revenue sharing at FY98 levels. So the reason we picked 98 levels is because it's not back in the heyday of what could be perceived as handing out money hand over fist. This was really the ratcheted down amount when we were becoming much more fiscally conservative, but still recognizing the important role that municipalities play in the delivery of services to all Alaskans. There's been so much discussion, I don't want to repeat any of it. Right now what we're seeing is that in many communities, staffing at the community level is skeletal. It's not unusual for clerks to work a half-day shift, usually about 4 hours, to answer phones and respond to mail, open mail. One of the things that we're seeing is that if no one is there to open the mail, no one is there to get the notices that there's free training available to apply for federal grants. And I really believe that we're shooting ourselves in the foot by not allowing for communities to have the staffing at least at the level where they can apply for federal grants. Many communities, like we talked about earlier, operate water, sewer, or electric utilities, as well as the dump. Many communities provide for public safety in terms of village public officers, public safety officers, or like the community of Anchorage provides Anchorage PD. Bethel provides the police department in Bethel. Many communities, like you said earlier, or like was discussed earlier, they plow the road at least to the airport so people can get in and out of town and get to fires if there's a fire. Many communities have volunteer fire departments, and this bill would help volunteer fire departments. In larger communities, the municipalities garner revenues to go towards schools and the bond debt reimbursement. Basically, what I see this bill doing is recognizing that at whatever level, these are constituents that need to be served, and we have a constitutional obligation to deliver certain services: public safety, public health, education, and transportation. And whether or not the services are delivered through a municipality or the state level, they have to be served. And I think that the choice is to have the municipalities close down and have that responsibility, that burden back on the state, and have line item appropriations at the state level and micromanagement, and perhaps not as good of delivery for these services provided by the state as could be delivered by the municipality. Many people recognize that while the state is very excited when the price of oil, the barrel of oil, goes to $60 a barrel, that's very good news for the state. However, for consumers and municipalities and small communities, that's very bad news, because we don't see the price of oil decrease again, and it's just money out of our pocket. Many people, I actually came down this session looking forward to this session, because I didn't think we'd be fighting tooth and nail over pennies the way we have been. I thought that there would be a little bit more generosity of spirit and an understanding that municipalities are hitting hard times, and that perhaps we could do something to help them. And again, Al Adams, former Senator Al Adams, used to have a plaque on his desk like this that said spend and save. And I really like that, because his theory was spend now, save later. You know, in other words, be pound wise and penny foolish, or penny wise and pound foolish is the opposite of spend and save in the way that I interpreted his theory. So with that, I'd like to open it up to any questions.
Representative Ledoux.
Well, I'm looking at table 2 here, which is the revenue sharing distribution to unincorporated communities. And I've got in my district 7 unincorporated communities, and none of them appear on this list.
Okay. I actually don't have the list that you're referring to in front of me. It's buried. Let me find it.
Says table 2, potential fiscal year 06 municipal revenue sharing distributions to unincorporated communities.
Okay. Again, this is in reference to the 98 allocation. So for whatever reason, and I wasn't in office at that point, but I'm not sure why your 7 communities weren't getting the appropriation at that point. But that's something we could certainly look at.
It was probably because they are unincorporated yeah. communities in an incorporated
borough. Okay.
But I guess I don't really see any reason why, just as we're giving revenue, just as we gave revenue sharing to incorporated communities in an incorporated borough, I don't see any reason to distinguish between unincorporated communities in an incorporated borough.
I think in 96, the legislature, because of an initiative started in the Senate, ratcheted back on the unincorporated contribution. But Bill Ralston, who's with us today, would probably be able to speak better to that than I would.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I see Matt LeCatler was a base 0, municipal revenue sharing was 0, and I was just wondering if you knew why they would have 0.
Again, perhaps Bill Ralston okay. would be better at answering that question.
And then, Mr. Chair, one, Bill, and Bill probably answered that one too, is these municipalities, they're listed from the 98 or 96 list. Like I know that the Gus Davis has filed for second class city status, and they're not listed on here. And I think municipality of Naukety that I know some, a lot of these communities, I didn't realize that it takes 2 to 3 years to get recognized as a municipality. And, I mean, it seems like we want to encourage them, and then you turn around and mm-hmm. take forever, you know, to get recognition. So, no one
to or worse yet, provide no incentive to become organized.
And one of them is dealing, and that was, we talked about the university bill, but the university had precedence over the municipality only because they're racing for the land. I said, that's not right. If you filed for municipality status a year and a half ago, you should get it first. But anyway, maybe we can ask somebody why, you know, maybe we should have the new cities. I mean, there's got to be some cities that organized since 1986, and they should be on here. You know, we want to incentives, not penalize them. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Representative Kapster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think first up in the audience, do you want to do Kathy or Kevin?
Kathy.
Okay. Kathy Wasserman?
It'd be quick.
Again, for the record, my name is Kathy Wasserman with the Alaska Municipal League. Representative Kapster brought up what to me is one of the most important things. We, as a state, say that we're in very good shape because the state is making so much money. And who indeed is that? When you live in a small community, you usually aren't able to see any of those positive things come down when your public services that you have come to depend on are no longer there, whether that's plowing your road, keeping your water running, keeping your water safe and clean. Sometimes it runs, but it's not something you want to utilize. We would just again like to say that with the rising fuel costs, which have almost doubled in most communities because that's how they keep their electricity going and sometimes their water and many of their other utilities, the rising costs of their insurance, which has almost again doubled, their PERS costs, which are going to be astronomical every year and completely put them at odds whether they can continue through that, with the loss of capital matching grants, the loss of revenue sharing yearly, and with no more reimbursement of the senior property tax and veterans property tax, it's very difficult for these communities to go. So we're totally in favor of Representative Kapster's bill, and we would hope that you would look favorably upon that. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Any questions for Ms. Wasserman? Mr. Ritchie, you're going to pass? Anybody in the audience wish to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative David Guttenberg from Fairbanks, and I'm speaking in support of this bill. In terms of what revenue assistance and municipal sharing do for communities across the state, being a Fairbanks legislature, I've seen the decline both in services based upon revenue sharing dollars. Part of my former life, I was a little road service commissioner. Monies we got for the state matched what our little service district would do to support our roads. That money's gone. In Fairbanks, a lot of service areas no longer tax themselves, and the roads are going to pieces. That includes the same takes place for little communities across the state that do get these. In the sense that the state's receiving higher oil revenues, the state has a responsibility to pass those dollars on to its communities. Many communities have no sustaining sources of income. They're efficient, they're lean, they're mean in some cases. That part-time employee sits there wondering, you know, what's going on in the world and not able to go into the office. You know, we've heard examples of small communities where no one's been able to open the mail to find out that they've been fined or they've been levied assessments from federal or insurance agencies. And they've gone delinquent on some things, and but it's key to this state to recognize that, especially in these times when oil is flush and we're doing well, that there's a responsibility to turn around and give the money back to the communities where it's most efficient, and that's a key part of what this is about, is putting the money back into the communities where it's most local, where the people have the most control of it, to do the things that they need to do at the local level that really impact their lives. Not only just reducing their property taxes and local taxes and local burdens on themselves, because in many cases people are doing that, but Putting the money back in the community, the rising tide lifts all boats, and this is an example of how we can take care of that. All of the local communities, the local people, is the most efficient thing you can do. It's part of the dialogue that goes on in this building all the time. What's the best thing that we can do? What's the most efficient thing? And giving the money back to the local communities where they can decide locally what needs to be done. Instead of coming down here and asking questions of agency people who might know because they've had a conversation with somebody back home. You know, they do a good job, but somebody sitting at home in a community, in a small community or in Fairbanks or in Anchorage, Juneau, wherever it is, knowing what needs to be done at the local level is a great advantage that we should be doing. Because when things fall apart at home, then they end up on our desk down here. And maintenance of dollars at home will prevent that. And I hadn't heard Senator Adams' comment, pay now, save later. That's a good example of, and a good rationale why we should be doing bills like these.
Any questions for Representative Gutman? Thank you. Anybody else wish to testify?
Morning. I'm Bobby Andrew, president for, excuse me, Electing Natives Limited, and this is the first time I'm doing this, so gotta bear with me. I have to thank Mary Kapsner for introducing this bill. And back in October 29th of 2000, our village of Electing signed an MOU to work together in order to address some of the issues that the village confronts, especially with the decline of monies coming into the village. And this bill becomes a reality, it's going to be helping some of the villages that don't have the tax base, basically because most of the lands within the communities are either town site or native allotments within a community. And one other area, many of the regional corporations have their main offices in the urban areas, and the economic base for those regional corporations aren't really within the region. Basically because there's no economic base within those villages. There's many needs in the village of Electingic, and one of those is improving the safe water program and also the sewer system. By doing this, or having this bill pass, would assist the village of Electingic with a very small population base. And it would help the village come up with the monies for city maintenance and also other projects. And some of the programs that the city applies for require matching dollars, and many of the villages in the rural areas aren't able to come up with those. And we're fortunate with the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation being able to utilize some of those in order to come up with some of those programs. You know, different projects. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
I have
other
questions, if I might.
You sure?
Brianna Dilubin. I was wondering who your MOU was with that you signed in 2000. The Memorandum of Understanding that Electingic signed.
Mm-hmm.
Who was that with?
That's with Electingic Natives Limited, the Village Corporation, the Electingic Traditional Council, and also the City of Electingic.
Okay, so your four local entities are partnering together.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
What we're doing is we're for different community projects, we meet quarterly, and then we discuss the areas that are important to the community. And we just recently had a meeting, and then we passed a resolution in support of this. Thank you.
Any other questions? Anybody else in the room wish to testify on this bill? It's the intent of the committee to bring back all three of the municipal assistant bills, Representative Roekberg's, Representative Kapsner's, and Representative Moses, and hopefully next week. And it should allow Representative Salmon enough time to meet with the three of them and address his concerns on the unincorporated areas.
Mr. Chairman, on the questions that I deferred to Bill Ralston, mm-hmm. could we call on him to answer those, please?
Certainly.
Okay.
For the record, Bill Ralston, employee of the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. The revenue sharing program was revised in 1980 to the current program that's in statute, and that program, that statute provides funding to only unincorporated communities within organized boroughs. So when the run was developed for Representative Kapsner, we went with what the existing law called for, and that was for funding only within organized boroughs. And as far as Gustavus and some of those other issues, I did a run for Ledge Resource about 2 months ago, I believe it was, in response to this bill, and I used the data that was in the system at the end of FY04 prior to the governor's veto as our most recent and most accurate to give a general estimate of what the payments would look like. So that's why there might be a Gustavus not on the list as a city when they should be and so on, but those are all fixable. We just have a general estimate at the time. But if this was enacted, of course, we'd update all the data. Everything would be current. Cities would be qualified as cities. I met Metlakatla. It was under revenue sharing. They received funding as an unincorporated community under safe communities. They received money as a municipality under capital matching grants for a long time. They received funding as an unincorporated, and that was changed to a municipality. So it's been changed over the years.
Representative Sisman?
Well, just as a question here, on table two, City of Gustavus is there. But it's under City of Gustavus. It's not. Is that different than? It is the same thing. It's not. There aren't two Gustavuses.
Through the chair, Representative Sisna. No, in 04 they were an unincorporated community, but now they are a city government. Okay.
Thank you.
Good to know what you look like.
Well, let's do something different.
Representative Sisna, the difference would be that amount of money they would get if they move from one table to the other, which they have.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Gonna cruise now?
Yeah.
Cruise.
We have anybody here on House Bill 2?
Thank you, Mayor.
If you want to give me 1 second, I have to pull Representative Gatto out of State Affairs Commission.
Yes, taking it easy.
Break that.
Good me to break you up. I'll entertain a motion.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt CS for House Bill number 2, version G.
I see no opposition. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2, of course, has a very low number. It's being developed ever since the opening day. In fact, historically, House Bill 2, under a different name, was brought forward even in the previous session under cruise ship head tax. What I will say is that we now have a presentation which hopefully will answer a great many questions, but I'm certainly here to answer any questions that the bill doesn't, or the presentation doesn't address. In the simplest possible terms, all the bill is asking is for the state of Alaska to be reimbursed for money it spent on behalf of an industry. That's it. That is the entire substance of the bill, just to be reimbursed for a portion of the expenses that are incurred by the presence of a certain industry. And with that, I will ask if it's okay to have my committee aide, Cody Rice, do the presentation on the PowerPoint.
I believe you're needed in another committee, aren't you?
I might be. If they do need me, they'll, for a vote, they'll come and get me. It's the PERS-TERS issues, and I don't think we're going to be voting on that for at least a while.
We have your name for the record, please.
Cody Rice, staff to Representative Carl Gatto. This PowerPoint is intended to anticipate and cover some of the issues that have been brought to Representative Gatto and myself regarding cruise ship taxes. This is essentially what areas are going to be covered, the ability of the cruise ship industry to pay, current contributions to the state, the impact, and the legality. There have been a lot of questions about the ability of the cruise ship industry to pay these taxes and about the effect it would have on the industry. Right here you have side by side some statements made by the senior vice president of Royal Caribbean about the impact of taxes on their industry. And at the same time, they were actually being sued for what was essentially called fraudulent head taxes. And they ended up settling out of court for, I believe, $125 million in cruise vouchers. I'll let that speak for itself. Here are some data as of 2004 on some of the financial data. This actually will be updated pretty soon. The 2005 annual reports are out, and it looks like this is actually pretty in line with the results from last year. I believe the net profit is up roughly 53% to 56% for Carnival again this year, and that's net profit. So you see, for 9 months, Carnival increased revenues 53%, Royal Caribbean increased net income 66%, Carnival increased net income 58%. And all of this is available in their annual reports and SEC filings. Here's an article from the Juneau Empire. Actually, I think it was an AP article, but this particular iteration is from the Juneau Empire. It covers the fact that prices have been rising for cruise trips, but that the largest resellers of cruises are saying that passengers are still cruising despite prices that are averaging 20% higher than last year, according to Managing Director Anthony Hamaway from Cruise.com, one of the largest online travel agencies. Yet at the same time, you're hearing that a $50 increase on a $1,200 package would be a significant increase in house finance. For you to decide. Here is an actual copy of a brochure for a Mexican cruise, and you can see the government fees of approximately $191.26 per person are additional. What we're proposing is $50 per head that would be only applicable once within 30 days, so if you sail twice within 30 days, you get an exemption the second time. Another Mexican cruise, an email from a travel agent as to what the taxes are on a Mexican cruise, and this one is $189.26 for charges and fees per person. These are Carnival Cruise Line revenues from 93 to 2003. The second 2003 on there was, I believe, a quarter of 2003, and they increased that much. I'll update this as well over the next couple days, and I'll be with each of your offices to provide updated data on what 2004 looked like. Carnival Cruise Line profits, and once again, 2003 to 2003B is one quarter, I believe, and that's why it flattens out a little bit there. With the information that I've seen from 2004, it should spike right back up. You can see that right around September 11th, there was a dip, but that they've responded pretty well, particularly in light of the fact that Carnival and I believe Royal Caribbean were building a significant number of ships, and cruise ships are very, very expensive. So to show significant profit while doing that is a testament to good business practices, I guess. This shows the number of passengers carried from 95 to 2003. You can see that they've gone through a 500% growth in the total passengers carried. And a significant amount of that has been from 2001 to now. Passenger capacity, see the same thing from 2001 to 2003. And it's flat from 2003 to 2003B again, because that's one quarter. This is the total number of ships. You're looking at from 2002 to 2003, they went from just over 40 to over 70 ships. And at least part of that was due to their acquisition of Princess Tours. But some of that also was a result of building new ships. In fairness to the cruise ship industry, they do contribute to charities in Alaska to the tune of more than $500,000 a year. And this is what they pay to DEC for air and water quality monitoring. It's actually decreased slightly from 2002 to 2003, and then increased about $100,000 to $844,000, which incidentally is, I believe, just less than $1 per passenger. This is a table that was compiled by OMB and the Department of Revenue last year for us and for information related to House Bill 537, which I think was the governor's tourism tax. And it lines out what the costs are that are potentially attributable to the cruise ship industry's presence in Alaska. And if you can't read that bottom number, it's, I believe, $115 million in potentially attributable costs to the state. And Department of Revenue can speak to the defensibility of these numbers. There's been some question about what the real number is. And I'm not an accountant, but I've been assured that the standards used to develop these numbers are generally acceptable accounting practices and meet the strictest legal guidelines.
Right off, I see about $60 million of that or more comes from airports, and there's no airport head tax. I'm looking at your chart there, $42 million and $11 million in Anchorage and $9 million Fairbanks. So that kind of just point out that it does skew the, you know, might be tourism dollars, but not cruise ship monies.
Through the chair, Chairman Thomas, again, I'm not an accountant, so I can't speak to the process behind developing this table, but I can tell you that I believe the assumption was that most cruise ship passengers do use one or more of the major airports to fly into or out of. Because most cruise passengers do not cruise round trip. They cruise one way, they fly one way. That may or may not be changing depending on who you talk to, but there is some usage of those airports by cruise passengers. And Department of Revenue and OMB work together to find an accurate number for that.
If I may, my understanding is that airport security systems are designed over peak, around peak loads, and there has to be some accountability that says we're going to receive kind of bubbles of passengers that come through the airports. And so the security systems have to be prepared with personnel as well as equipment to handle the peak loads. And so some portion of that is attributable to tourists that arrive on a cruise ship but are going to fly home. And so they've proportioned the amount that the airport had to essentially have in place as that amount that is attributable only to this group of people.
The final issue is legality, and that's something that we've heard about quite frequently, particularly the Maritime Transportation Security Act of, I believe, 2002. And it states, it's quoted in here, as no taxes or tolls except reasonable fees charged on a fair and equitable basis that, quote, are used solely to pay for the cost of a service to the vessel or watercraft, enhance the safety and efficiency of interstate commerce, do not impose more than a small burden on interstate or foreign commerce. I think you'll see in version G of the bill before you, a lot of those words are reiterated in how the state will distribute funds, that funds will be used to distributed for things that enhance the safety and efficiency of interstate commerce, and that are based on, as the previous chart showed, costs attributable to the industry's presence in Alaska and costs specifically to the state from the industry's presence in Alaska. And the first part of the presentation goes to whether or not it imposes a small burden on interstate or foreign commerce, whether or not $50 per passenger is more than a small burden. The disposition of receipts or proceeds on the most recent version of the bill is modeled after the cruise ship initiative, and that's for several reasons. It makes it more substantially similar, and it also falls more in line with the AG's opinion by Attorney General Rehnquist, which addressed some of the legal issues, including the question of whether it was a dedicated fund. And there's an October 6, 2003 memo that should be in your packets, and there should be arrows at the relevant portions. But one excerpt says, while there are limitations imposed by federal law on the purposes for which the excise tax in Section 1 of the proposed bill can be used, it would be a mistake to interpret this federal restriction as creating a dedicated fund. Because the way that the bill works now is there's a sub-account, and the sub-account is used to meet the standards required in the MTSA. And the receipts go into this sub-account and then are used to pay back the $5 per port for the first five ports, as well as there's a regional sub-account, which 25% of the receipts will go to covering the costs of regional areas that may or may not necessarily be a port, but still feel the impact of the cruise ship industry. And then the remainder goes to the state general fund for usage only on such projects as enhance the safety and efficiency of interstate commerce. Because we can't escape the fact that the MTSA requires these funds to be spent on those things. The question is whether or not creating those subaccounts creates a dedicated fund by state standards. The Attorney General wrote an opinion in 2003 that while it did satisfy federal standards for creating a dedicated fund, it did not violate state standards for creating a dedicated fund. So if anyone has any more legal questions on that line, you can consult the Attorney General's opinion. And that's the end of the presentation.
Chairman, can we just something I want to talk about in one of this? I think the second slide. Can we go back to that? Keep going back. Yeah.
Which one?
It's the second one that had, I think, the bullets. I wanted to get to. There's only four bullets here. The first one I wanted to address was the ability to pay. The cruise ship companies are, as you've seen from some of the other slides, enormously profitable. And I do not mean doing well. I mean anybody who can get a 50-something percent increase in profits in a single year is the company that I want to be part of. But that they've continuously commented that any tax that would be, any $50 tax would hurt their business. that hasn't been borne out by the facts. The facts are that last year when we brought this bill up, there were 800,000 passengers coming to Alaska. This year the plan is for 900,000 passengers. When you interview the passengers that arrive here and you ask them about their experiences or whether or not they thought it was too costly, you find out that most of them shrug off a $50 tax because, A, they've discovered that if they've ever cruised anywhere else, the taxes are substantially more. For instance, as ABC Travel has indicated, when we cruise to Mexico, the port fees are $150. That's $50 per port because there are three ports. What we're asking for in the Alaska, even though they visit five ports, would be only $50 grand total, or only $10 a port. So the customers or the clients are already paying a significant amount to other places and are fairly used to simply saying that there are port fees and charges. The current contributions to the state are essentially zero. I believe there may be 1 or 2%. Is there any at all to the state? There is some question about that, but it is, it's you know, DEC cost, that is pretty minimal, the current contributions to the state. The impact on their ability to continue to prosper in this environment, it's very important for me to say to you that this is a primary destination. Fully 10% of their cruise market comes to Alaska, and that will probably continue to increase for some time. As you've seen from other slides, they continue to build more ships. They wouldn't do that unless the prospects for filling those ships were very clear and convincing, because they're the size of an aircraft carrier. The amount of money they spend to build a ship is enormous. It has a long lifespan. It's not a decision that is lightly taken by them. For them to even, for anyone to suggest that the $50 head tax will certainly hurt their business, I mean, I think a penny head tax would hurt it, but to the degree where it becomes insignificant. And as far as the legality is concerned, the argument is very often the statement that, well, it's illegal. But that's not a decision that I think we can make in committee. It's not a decision that the cruise ship companies can make. That's why we have a court system. It doesn't matter that we pass any tax if it's illegal. They certainly wouldn't be hurt by that. So that question is not a question for us to even be concerned with here, unless you could read a statute that clearly says cruise ship taxes are illegal in any form. But there is no statute that says that. My concern, for the most part, from the state's point of view is, if indeed Department of Revenue projections are correct, we are already spending a certain amount of money to support the industry. Their argument is, and I've heard this argument many times, and I want to make this one really clear, they do not like targeted taxes. I'm going to say it again. They do not like targeted taxes. But mining is a targeted tax. Timber is a targeted tax. Tourism, other than cruise ships, are targeted taxes. Oil and gas, if there's anything that's a targeted tax, certainly 85% of our economy is a targeted tax. In fact, I'm at a loss to find a non-targeted tax. I don't know of any, except you could say a sales tax would be a non-targeted tax, but it isn't. The more you spend, the more you pay. It's targeted on people that can pay the most. And a state income tax is certainly a targeted tax on just wage owners. So we do not have non-targeted taxes in existence. The cruise ship industry has said they would support a sales tax and an income tax for the state. And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that is not surprising. They would support a sales tax and an income tax because they don't pay any part of that. Remember that the whole point here is to recover some of the costs we are currently expending on their behalf. All we are wanting to do is recover the costs, and House Bill 2 is the way to do that. Thank you. I'll take questions now.
Representative Ledoux.
Do any other states have cruise ship head taxes?
Hawaii does. They disembark a lot from Florida and from the Los Angeles port. I can't remember the name.
San Pedro?
San Pedro, right, from San Pedro. I know Bermuda has a $60 tax, and that's only for a single port. Like we mentioned, the Mexican ones where they have about $50 a port. Jamaica, the Virgin Islands, and their Caribbean cruises. Now, where in the states, I think they go up the Mississippi, and they have gambling while they're doing that. There is quite a bit of revenue they can get from ports. The tricky thing about cruise ships is their ability to do what's called port pulling. It's a practice that they exercise comfortably, and it says, you know, people coming to Alaska are going to want to see Juneau. And if Juneau has a $5 tax, we're going to live with it. But if Haines has a $5 tax, we're going to go somewhere else. We'll be able to simply say, if you charge us anything. So Whittier ran into this problem. Whittier tried to impose a tax, and it was pretty minimal, and they disappeared from Whittier in a flash. It's great to have a cruise ship. You go to a different port at will. And they have been playing us off against ourselves for some time by simply saying, it's a free market, we can go where we want. The beauty of this is it simply says, let's collect a certain amount of money up front, and the point was to give it to the first five ports of call. They can go where they want. They're going to pay the same in each port of call. And so the goal was to make this the most enjoyable adventure for passengers imaginable. And therefore, we would have to intervene to make this so that ports of call aren't left in the wind. Because when you invest in your community's infrastructure and the ships say, listen, a dollar is something that we're not going to put up with. And so then leave a community, that's pretty hard on a community to say, well, I think I'll open a business there, but my gosh, don't tax them even a penny, even though we've earned the right to tax them, because we give them something that they can't get anywhere else, and we give them arguably the most beautiful scenery in the world, and they sell it. They sell the product that we give them for free. In all fairness, I think if we're going to tax our other industries, it's just fair to go ahead and say, this is reasonable. You certainly have more than the ability to pay it. It's minor. In fact, you're not paying it. You're going to charge it to your customers. It's to reimburse the state. The impact is minor. And if you're really worried about the legality, let's concentrate on the legality question in the courts.
Representative Ledoux, I have a feeling you'd want to follow up.
Yes, I do want to follow up, and it does relate to the legality, so that's why I was asking you the question, do any other states, not Mexico or the Virgin Islands or Bermuda, do they have head taxes? And so I guess I'm wondering, if they do, whether they have met and gone through constitutional challenges, because if it were legal there, presumably it would be legal here.
And why?
That I'm aware of, no other states have head taxes. However, it is my understanding in discussions with the drafter of the MTSA provision, Don Young's Transportation Committee attorney, as well as our alleged legal attorneys, that the MTSA as drafted is so broad that it invalidates quite a few existing taxes, such as taxes on riverboats on the Mississippi River, individual port taxes in Florida and Hawaii. Most other states do not have statewide head taxes, and I believe that that's in fitting with the difference in size and the difference in number of ports versus Alaska. Alaska's a lot of times got a more centralized
representative.
So there are individual communities in other places that have taxes, but you're suggesting that you've gotten information that if those taxes in those communities were challenged on constitutionality, that the MTSA would preempt them or something like that?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that depends entirely on how they spend the receipts in most cases. And in a lot of those communities, the receipts are not necessarily spent solely on costs attributable to the vessel and to enhance the safety and efficiency of interstate commerce. And if it doesn't meet those clauses, then it doesn't meet the MTSA. And in those locations, they may have problems. The way that our bill is specifically drafted would, I believe, meet those standards and would require the legislature to appropriate the receipts only in ways that meet those standards.
Thank you.
And if I can add, in San Pedro, there's a lot of shipping that goes on there besides cruise ships. I mean, there's cargo containers as far as the eye can see. Their infrastructure is already in place to handle large vessels. If it weren't for the cruise ships, we don't have a need for vessels this size. So we do have an infrastructure that has to be constructed in order to accommodate the only large vessels that are truly arriving here.
Representative Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question. If you've ever been to Juneau during the summer when there's five cruise ships out here, you're saying Juneau's the impacted community, but if you come in from Angoon and Hoonah, Kaneki, Gustavus to go shopping here, you're pretty well displaced. I mean, I've been to Costco's where it takes an hour and a half to get out of there. They don't go in there and shop for one thing anymore. So, and referring to your impact money that you're going to give to the municipalities for $250, I think the money should go outside the communities where they have no cruise ships, because, again, when you come to town, it you know, you can't get around. You know what it's like at the end of session here when the ships are in. I think the impacted communities are the ones that are outside that are trying to come in here to do, you know, trade or enterprise, you know, versus the local municipalities generate, I'm going to save $4 million a year on the sales tax. So what, now you're going to give another $4.5 million per community. Maybe you should look at giving it to the communities outside. Imagine Craig, Kluwak, Heidelberg, Metlakatla, Hyder are all like that when they try to go to Ketchikan. I mean, that's, I've never been there on a cruise day, but I probably will this year.
Representative Cessna?
No, thank you very much.
You look like you're on the verge of a question.
No, just the thought of that is really very interesting. That the impacts are the impacts are the people who didn't get the cruise ships and what that did to that community. They decided not to go there, so that community gets impacted. This community's making money. However, does that money make up for the expense? The local community, because it's the local community that builds the, that's a question. The question is, does Juneau, for instance, for all its port facilities, why did it do it without, I mean, I'm assuming that they make a profit, that in the end they see that being revenue positive for the city in order to do that.
I think the cruise ships called Juneau a must-see. It doesn't matter how much money Juneau charges the cruise ships. They're not going to bypass it. And I think they consider Skagway on the same lines, as you can't simply sail by and, oh, there goes Juneau, you have to stop. So Juneau and Skagway have these, just have a lock on ships stopping here. My concern is the other communities, and with respect to Representative Thomas's question, I believe there is a sub-account that will take care of impacted communities. You could elucidate on that.
There's a 25%, 25% of the receipts go into what's called a regional sub-account, and that is specifically designed to go to communities that are impacted but may not necessarily be a port of call, as long as the money is used to enhance the safety and efficiency of interstate commerce. And that's up to the local communities and the state to determine that those standards are being met. But that money is intended to go not just to ports of call, but to other surrounding areas that may very well be impacted. And that's something that we're aware of.
Yeah, and one of your tables that I referred to, well, the impacts were on Anchorage and Fairbanks. I think, you know, regional impacts will be probably heading north instead of staying here in southeast where the cruise ship impacts are major. I mean, you're saying in your thing, that your graph here, that about $60 million impact to the Anchorage Stevens Airport and the Fairbanks one, and I guess, you know, you'll generate revenue here only to siphon it off and go north with it, but I'm, you know, thinking, I'm just looking at your own paper here that shows, you know, if you're going to show impact, you show more than anybody else in southeast here.
Through the chair, Chairman Thomas, I can't predict where the future legislature will send the money.
I
count on you to take care of southeast.
Oh, yeah.
Representative Salmon.
Yes. I noticed last couple of years people were complaining in Fairbanks that we don't have enough tourists. I mean, if we were to tax so much for the cruise, I mean, the major portion of the route of the tourists is through up, you know, up the southeast on the cruise ship, goes to Fairbanks, over to the airport, then they go up the highway, look at Denali and on to Fairbanks, and from there they catch another plane to wherever. I mean, there's a kind of route. And, you know, $50 head tax, you know, I think will impact the people further up north. And I think we should look at that, you know, part of the world. I mean, you know, it's because you have a lot of people down here. I mean, we should embrace them that they're spending money in Alaska. You know, they're spending money in hotels and Fairbanks, Anchorage, you know, and Denali Park. So I think we shouldn't, you know, just keep taxing them so to a point where they don't want to come up, you know. So it's my theory and idea of it.
Any other questions? I'd like to apologize. We've got several people signed up to testify in the audience today, and I don't think we're going to have enough time, but we will bring it up again on Thursday. And I believe we'll have enough time on them to get to everybody. Did we have anybody call in? Nope.
Not an issue.
Well, with that, I think we'll adjourn.